It's the International Workers' Day edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, asteroid mining, Nutella ain't healthy, unfaithful analytics, and Narconon, Scientology on drugs. Let's begin episode 164.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, the not forgetful philosopher and political scientist. Ethan.
Yes.
It is a day for the workers to rise up and destroy the machine of capitalism. Well, okay, it's International Workers' Day, which is a very important day for us normal folks. International Workers' Day actually originated in 1886 with the Haymarket riots, which was a strike for the eight-hour day, something we all kind of appreciate to have, although some of us want to work longer. But people don't like to work longer. We keep forgetting that you go back to the heyday of industrial capitalism, people were working literally 12, 16 hours a day, and they had very little money. And so part of this was the rise of the union movement. In 1894, there were the actual May Day riots, which again were in support of union and unionization. In 1984, the International Socialist Conference created the International Workers' Day, which is what we currently celebrate, although most of us refer to it as May Day, although technically May Day is slightly different. May Day is actually sort of a pagan Christian holiday, and this is sort of the workers' holiday, so they're slightly different. But as we speak, there are tens of thousands, if not millions of people marching in the street, trying to support unions, workers' rights, and just a decent society to live in.
Well, and did you know about the famed Canadian connection to workers' rights was the Winnipeg mass riots, which was one of the big wake-up calls around the world that, hold on a second, maybe working workers to the breaking point was a bad idea.
Exactly. The general strike that occurred in Winnipeg, which was, I think, 1905.
I'm not probably sure around that area, yeah.
But it was amazing because, I mean, it started out as sort of a very small level union debate, disagreement between one particular working area, but it turned into a general strike, and literally the entire city shut down and forced the establishment to kind of give in a bit. And it was a wonderful movement for labor, and it was also one of the kernels that started things like the CCF and the socialist movement in Canada, which is why it is so much better to be a worker and a regular person. I mean, how many people out there are not workers? Well, you're going to have a few people who are going to be, you know, down on their luck. One or two of them may be lazy and are not working, in which case the socialist system is great because it allows you, you know, the breathing room that if you're ill, you don't have to work. If you're mentally ill, you don't have to work. You have a safety net. The rest of us the rest of those who are not workers are like 1% of 1% of the very top. Really, the majority of us are workers. And why people are so against things like unions and workers' rights is so inane. I have one friend of mine who, in one degree, I kind of agree with, but I disagree in the general point, who's really annoyed that some union workers have special rights. For example, like the unionized workers at the university here, right? They get special rates and discounts on their children coming to the university. Now, in the one sense, well, why do they get a special rate and I don't? But at the same time, if you can give it to them, why can't you give it to us, right? The rights that they gain tend to work down to everyone if we let it, if we fight the real fight. But right. That is, of course, my socialist rant for the day.
On to the capitalist rant for the day, well, which has something to do with money, actually.
Exactly. The Canadian Mint is releasing its first, and I think it's the world's first, although I had trouble finding this out, glow-in-the-dark quarter. Apparently, it's going to be a Pachyrhinosaurus lactatea. which I hope is right, a 4-ton, 26-foot dinosaur discovered in Alberta in 1972. Now, granted, the coin itself is not going to be 4 tons and 26 feet long, but it is going to be a glow-in-the-dark. So when you look at the quarter in regular light, it will be like, you know, a living artist's rendition of the dinosaur. And when you turn out the lights, you see its skeleton underneath. Apparently, you know, it only takes about 45 seconds to charge up the fluorescence, and it will last indefinitely. Now, I'm sure there is a lifetime on it. Physics says it has to, but apparently it'll last for almost ever. Although the face value of it is 2 bits, it's going to be a little larger than a quarter, and the only way actually to get it is through a collector's agency. I think 1/4 is $30, so it's not something you're going to be putting into the coin machine anytime soon. That being said, actually, I was surprised to discover that actually the Royal Canadian Mint is a world leader in the numismatic arts. We apparently have a patented process, which is being copied by everyone in the world, for bimetallic coins, such as our toonie. You know how we've got the little bronze center and the silver outline? Well, it wasn't the first bimetallic coins used, but its particular process is considered to be one of the best. Hmm. They also created a new multi-ply plating technique, which sounds a little technical, but essentially it's a way of applying metallic layers over cheap cores. So although the coins don't cost anything to make, they at least look like they have some value. And then, of course, which is the real biggie that we've done, is we've created color coins. If anyone remembers the red poppy quarter that was out in 2004, that was a world's first. And if you look at, like, say, the collector's coins, there are all sorts of colored coins. Well, that's a Canadian thing. Woo-hoo, let's be proud. So, of course, you know, now they've added to that repertoire of great things. And in the dark, you'll know what change you have because it'll glow at you.
Well, it's nice that they've included a sort of pro-science image for this glow-in-the-dark quarter. I mean, you know, it's I prefer it over to say something like a, you know, glow-in-the-dark battleship or a glow-in-the-dark fighter jet or...
Oh, apparently New Zealand either has one out or it's coming out, and it's a Star Wars theme.
Oh, well...
I know. So now you're sitting there, okay, where am I going to get my geek on, right? I mean, do I go for the dinosaurs, which is really cool, or Star Wars, which is really cool, but for in a different way?
Well, wait, is it like a Star Wars thing from the original trilogy or from the prequels?
Oh, yeah.
If it's from the prequels, they're probably going to suck.
Yeah, if there's Jar Jar Bar on there, man.
That's not going to help their currency value.
No, but actually, one of the things that apparently went into the thinking about releasing this coin is that for kids, and the idea is to get kids interested in science because kids love dinosaurs. It's a bit of a stereotype, but that was one of the thinking that was going in there is to excite children about it. And they go, wow, isn't this cool? You not only turn them on to coin collecting, which I think is really, really cool, but you're also kind of educating them. I mean, that underneath us all are a bunch of bones, and these bones can literally last for millions of years, and that your body, Ethan, as wonderful as it is now, may be spectacular 10 million years now as some alien archaeologist digs it up and says, oh, it's an Ethan.
Well, there you go. I've always wanted to be an Ethan. Oh, the other cool thing about this, I mean, the fact that they made it glow in the dark, I mean, it does obviously, like, this is probably something that, you know, a grandfather's going to buy for his grandkids, you know, and they're going to get one of those framed little things. They're going to go, oh, a quarter I can't take out of the box. But, I mean, at the same time, like, it is still pretty neat. Like, glow in the dark, okay, it's kind of a little more for the kids, but at the same time, really cool way to, impress a bit of science onto the young folk out there, and especially because Canada actually does have a really great, collection of fossil finds, in Alberta and such. So a good way to sort of showcase our heritage and a bit of science.
Actually, there's another thing, too. I mean, so far, like you say, these are sort of collector's items, but there is the possibility as paper money or plastic money now sort of disappears, and they want coinage to last longer, it strikes me as this would be a great way to prevent counterfeiting. You know, I mean, one with the color coins and the glow in the dark, those strike me as technologies that are way above what a regular counterfeiter could do, or even an advanced counterfeiter could do. Because, again, a lot of these are patented technologies that only we can do and no one else can seem to emulate. And like I say, so if you have your $20 coin, right? I mean, I'm sure the penny, as it is, costs more to make as it is. So adding glow in the darkness would not be economically viable. But it would seem that, you know, if we have a $5 coin or a $10 coin, which is what they're thinking of maybe doing in the future, that it might actually be worthwhile to throw in a little glow in the darkness. That way there, you know, it's an original and not some forgery.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, I know they are thinking of taking away the penny, or they're planning on, or they've already started. I'm not quite sure where.
The penny is toast at the end of this year. 2012 is the last penny you're ever going
to
get.
Yeah, so hang on to those pennies, folks. But I mean, the other thing you mentioned there with regards to counterfeiting. I mean, I thought the whole point of having plastic money was that it was "quote unquote" going to be impossible to counterfeit because it's going to have all these weird, like, symbols and stuff on that you can't even see, that it has to go through a special kind of X-ray or something like that.
No, that's actually quite true. And actually, I'm not saying that the plastic money that we're getting, the $20 bill, the new plastic version of the $20 bill, I think is coming out today or sometime this week. They're going to be sort of showing it. No, it's the idea of how long it can last. I mean, the reason why we went from sort of the old paper coinage to the plastic bills is that they last a lot longer, or at least that was the theory, right? Mm-hmm. But as it's turning out, there have been a number of people who have been complaining about the new 50s and that coming out, that one, they're prone to tear, so if you get a little nick in them, boom, it rips right through and it gets destroyed. And two, they're sensitive to some heat. Now, of course, how bad these issues become, but a coin will last, I think the coins have something like 20 or 30 year life expectancy before they sort of wear out, whereas the paper bills had like a 1 year life expectancy. So every year you kind of had to reprint a certain amount of them because they'd wear out in that time.
Right.
And the plastic ones, I think, are supposed to last about 5 years. So the idea, if you make a metal coin as a bill, it costs you a lot more sort of to make the bill now, but you're not remaking it every 5 years. You're only making it once every generation.
So it's like a long-term investment.
Exactly. Yeah, pay now or pay later.
Right. Well, we're kind of talking about coins and precious metals. Let's jump to precious metals in the sky.
Yes. We're going to talk about mining asteroids. Okay, so there's not a lot more to add to that. It's pretty self-explanatory. They're going to go with the asteroids and they're going to do some mining. Now, this is what happens when a bunch of rich people have more money than they really need. They've decided to fund a company that may someday send out a series of robotic mining chips that will travel to the asteroids and send back billions in rare earth metal. Now, it's not quite as eccentric as it may sound, but it's definitely future tech. The asteroids that are targeting are not the ones that we think of. I mean, when we think of asteroids, you think of the ones between Mars and Jupiter, the classic asteroid belt. They're not going for there. They're actually going for something a lot closer, near Earth asteroids. Now, the first step that they're planning to do this, well, first of all, I'm going to take one moment. I've been hearing a lot about this in the news, and a lot of them are just mentioning they're going to go to the asteroids and they're going to mine and they're going to make riches, and it sounds like, well, really far-fetched and all that. But when you go a bit more into what they're actually doing, it's not quite as crazy as it sounds. So there's a multi-step sort of process. The first step that they're going to do is they're going to launch a series of satellites that will have small telescopes on them that will look in our local vicinity for near-Earth objects that could have mineral wealth on them. So essentially, they're going to do the whole scanning thing, and they're going to see what's on them. What they're looking for are both metals, notably rare earth metals like niobium, and platinum group metals, which are things like platinum, palladium, and all that, which run at a value of about $1,000 an ounce, although rhodium was selling for over $10,000 an ounce in 2008.
Wow,
I wouldn't mind having a couple ounces of that. But they're also, of course, looking for water. Why water? Well, not because they're thirsty, but water's big value is that it's a source of hydrogen, which is a main component in any fuel you're going to make. There's lots of carbon out there, too, so you mix the hydrogen with the carbon, take the sun for power, and you create rocket fuel, essentially.
Well, the other reason that they'd want to find water in space is because it's really, really expensive to get water from Earth to space. And if they could find a source out there that they could, you know, I guess, well up from an asteroid and then, you know, purify it, it would save them a ton of money in supplying the space station or astronauts or whatever.
Exactly. One of the big, that could be one of the main funding sources is the idea of refueling spaceships in space. Now, of course, once they've selected a suitable target, and again, now we're talking decades probably from now, they will send out robotic miners, which no one has created or designed yet, so we're not quite sure how they will actually be. But essentially, they're just plans to be huge magnets on sort of rakes that will go through the regolith, the dirt, soil, dust that's on top of these asteroids. And the rich stuff, the metals and all that, will be attracted to it. And they'll do sort of a pre-sorting on the asteroid and then send back the valuable stuff to actual processing. And ironically enough, I mean, we say it's really expensive to send stuff into space. Ironically enough, it's incredibly cheap to send it back. Just make sure you're not underneath it when it lands. Although, of course, too, some people speculated that this is where mining, refining operations on the moon will occur. So they'll send it to the moon, which, one, is safer. If an accident happens, you're not going to wipe out Detroit. And two, well, I don't know what it's to. I guess it'd be cheaper up there. I'm not sure how that would work. But.
Well, I mean, it would be expensive to build the thing on the moon. It really sort of depends. Like, if they plan on basically just bringing back, say, huge piles of raw platinum, and then say, okay, here's a big pile of it. Where do you want it? Who wants to buy it? And auctioning it off to the highest bidder type thing, then they could just bring it down. That would work as well. I mean, the backers for this are some pretty impressive lot. You got people from, like, Google. You got James Cameron. I mean, well, that's not really a surprise. But a whole bunch of people. And I saw some quotes in the news. I believe what's the Japanese physicist?
Michiako.
Yeah. He was quoted as saying these people are rich enough and crazy enough to actually do this. So I think you need to have a bit of both.
Well, yeah, but let's be so one of the other plans that they have to do with this, right? I mean, so they got the raking from – they got one that sort of evaporates the minerals out. But another plan that they have, again, going back with the water, is essentially to sort of create a bottle in space.
Mm-hmm.
Shove the asteroid into this bottle so they kind of have it enclosed, and then melt off the water that's inside of it, process it, and that's what turned into a fueling station. Now, again, on paper, simple.
Yeah.
But it's like a rocket. I mean, like, I look there, and they're talking about recently about how North Korea has tried to launch a rocket into space. India recently did it, right? And I'm going, well, how hard is it to build a rocket? You just put a bunch of fuel, you got a little spout at the bottom, and it fires off. But if you ever actually look at the innards of a rocket, my God, they're incredibly complex. It's like, why do you need all these pipes and wires? It seems inane. But again, I trust that you do need all these pipes and wires. So this sort of bottling an asteroid may look simple in theory, but I'm quite sure when it comes time to actually create it, it's going to be quite different. Now, the target asteroids that they're going for are going to be anywhere from tens of meters to tens of kilometers. And they are about 0.04 AUs away. Astronomical units, that's the word.
Not a parsec.
No. Well, and again, of course, that's relatively speaking. Because, I mean, they're actually all in similar orbits to Earth. But they're either a little closer, a little farther from the sun, or sort of just ahead or just behind us in their orbit. So, again, we're not talking about super space travel. That being said, 0.04 AUs, according to my bad math, is about 6 million kilometers, or about 20 times the distance from here to the moon. And we all know how easy it is for us to get to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
The initial investment, though, is, of course, like I say, this is just the first step. And as you say, crazy people with a lot of money can do some interesting stuff. Well, they're just actually going to put these telescopes up into the orbit to do the search, which is only going to be about $10 million per telescope, which, honestly, for space telescopes, that's pretty cheap. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, of course, that with all this press coverage they've gotten, and now the cynical side of Dawn comes out, I'm sure that has not hurt their ability to find investors in this particular project. And we've had some interesting things before. So, again, as you're sort of saying, you know, I sort of applaud their far-reaching plans for the future. But, of course, it's still a little far-fetched.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know how well they've thought this through. Probably, I think, I mean, they got some intelligent folks behind this. But, I mean, it seems like they're not really anticipating a lot of problems. Like, I mean, how many rockets explode without even actually getting off the ground? A lot. You know, I mean, you look at how many problems you can have with just getting a rocket up if the weather's bad. So, I mean, they're going to have to sit there and go, okay, so there's an asteroid coming by the Earth. It's going to be here on, you know, June 6th. So we need to get our thing up there in time to catch it. Well, you know, what if they have a week of bad weather, right? Like, I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong with this. Now, that all being said, it's still pretty cool. And, you know, you can have that argument about private versus public space exploration. Since this is somebody else's money, I don't really care too bad, you know, if it goes wrong. If it's like, you know, well, not NASA because we're Canadian, but, you know, if I was American and it was NASA, I'd be like, well, geez, you know, you're kind of wasting a lot of money when we could be, you know, building bridges and repaving roads. So there's a certain – that debate, I mean, isn't as big for this issue.
I think I would agree with you on that. But there is one thing I think that we all should be a little concerned about, again, being too early in the mission, is that if they do fail, right? And as you point out, you know, as much as they want to put efforts into this, if they do fail, that may actually put a kibosh to any follow-up attempt in the near future, right? I mean, it was a small accident that sort of destroyed the nuclear industry in the States. Mm-hmm. Don't forget Tesla, the electric car, and the Evo One, which were supposed to herald a new generation, but they kind of failed. And in their failure, it's kind of put a, it put a nix on anything like that for decades, if not maybe forever. Mm-hmm. So their failure, above and beyond the private-public debate, and can we spend the money in better areas, I do really honestly hope them success, not because I want them to get rich, but if they are successful, this may have a spin-off effect where other people will do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll have to keep our eye on this story for sure. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. So stay tuned to CITR 101.9 FM, and we'll be back after this.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
2012 Grammy Award winners, Tedeschi Trucks Band brings their blues-inspired show to the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts for one night, June 19th. Tickets on sale this Friday at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.ca or by calling 855-985-5000. Don't miss Tedeschi Trucks Band on June 19th at the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts. For more information, go to TedeschiTrucks.com.
Well, I came to the city. I was running from...
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beach Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back. Now, you know, I found out that Nutella ain't good for you.
Now, I'm not surprised by this. A couple of years ago, I was in Europe for a vacation. And Nutella is very popular in Europe. And everybody would put it on their toast. And this is like chocolate fudge, right? And so I'd be down there having breakfast, and someone would come in and scoop like a big pile of Nutella on their toast and smear it all up. And I'd be like, how can you eat that in the morning? It is so sweet. Like, it's so good for you. And I'm like, don't you guys ever have like scrambled eggs and bacon? They're like, bacon for breakfast? Oh, ew. And I'm just like, how can you say that? It's Nutella. It's pure fudge.
They say as they're sipping their wine.
Yeah, I mean, oh.
Well, for those of you who don't know what Nutella is, which, of course, Ethan obviously does, Nutella is a chocolate and hazelnut paste spread that's kind of like peanut butter, but a lot better. Think of it as sort of a spreadable chocolate bar for toast. It's advertised as being perfect on multigrain toast and even whole wheat waffles, and made with simple and good ingredients. Now, of course, take note, multigrain toast, whole wheat waffles, there's an implication there of its healthiness. You point out that if it had a stop there, it would have been probably okay. Our little chocolate sin, but, you know, it's kind of worth it. However, Nutella pushed the boundaries of acceptable ad spin. In some of its ads, it claimed to be a tasty yet balanced breakfast, that it was nutritious, and that it was a healthy breakfast, for which, you know, leads one to think that although it may taste like a butt-busting fat factory, it's really not. Well, apparently a mother in San Diego read the ad copy, and actually if it's in print, it must be true, or at least they couldn't print lies. And on one level, I guess that's true, because they did print it and they got sort of away with it. But in a recent court case, where she sued Ferrello, the people who make Nutella, She won $3 million class action lawsuit. Well, so she won $500,000 for her own, but $2.5 million is set up as a class action lawsuit. And anyone, at least in the States, who bought Nutella between January 28th to January 12th can sue and get some money back. And the reason, of course, she won is because she said, well, they led me to believe that this was a healthy part of a breakfast, when really it was like leading to obesity. It was bad for my kids. I was feeding it to my kids, thinking it was a healthy part of my diet. Of course, this leads to, you know, many different sort of angles we could take on this. I'm not sure where you'd like to go with it, Ethan. I was thinking of things like, I mean, this whole idea of truth in advertising, personal responsibility. I mean, really, if you've ever had Nutella, if you looked at the ingredients on the side of it, right, it's pretty obvious that this is a chocolate bar in a bottle. There's also the whole idea of the role of government, both at regulating ads, nutritional contents, and when they should set in there. And I mean, there's a lot of issues. What kind of spin do you think on this, Ethan?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the whole thing about someone being surprised. This isn't a healthy thing for you to eat. Really surprised? It is pure chocolate. I mean, this thing is like eating a mocha frappuccino with Oreos in it. Like, it is very sweet. There is no way that you could possibly eat this and be like, oh, that was very healthy. Yes.
No, it could have been artificial sugars, which are supposed to be not nearly as bad for you. Although, if you have enough artificial sugar, most of the artificial sugars are a form of sugar. So if you have a lot of it, you will get into the same problem. But
well, I mean, it does say simple quality ingredients, which could imply that the ingredients are simple in that they are not complex chemicals. And quality could mean, well, they're really good, unhealthy things.
Well, just like the idea of its nutrition. I mean, sugars and fats are nutrients. Your body needs them. I mean, there are billions of people in the world who would, well, are literally dying if they could only have this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I guess in that sense, it's true. But you must admit, the way they advertise, you know, perfect on multigrain toast. Well, multigrain toast is not something you associate with sort of a fat food, right? I mean,
yeah.
And it goes to the idea, too. I mean, you're right. There's a certain degree, I think, of personal responsibility. I mean, how many times have, well, you haven't heard me, but I have railed against this. You do not need to put on a blow dryer. Do not use in the shower. If you use your blow dryer while having a shower, you're really doing society a benefit, honestly, right? I mean, you know, and on the top step of a ladder where it says, do not step further. Well, duh, of course not, right? So in that sense, I think there is a certain amount of personal responsibility. But the idea, though, that, you know, can advertisers, given personal responsibility, still get away with saying anything they want? I mean, if I say, buy Radio Free Thinker toast, and you'll be a healthy person, and it won't cause you any problems, and you'll never have to worry about tooth decay again, and it turns out our toast is just petrified sugar, I mean, you should know as a consumer that, hey, I'm lying. But should I be allowed to lie to you in the first place? Or at least stretch the boundaries of truth to beyond credible?
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, I have seen some of the ads for Nutella, and they were pretty outrageous in their claims. Like, they were quite, oh, this is a really healthy, good thing, nutritious for kids. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. I mean, of course it's not. Come on now. It's pure chocolate. But, I mean, it's a balancing act, right? I mean, if a company is going to go out there and make a statement like that, they should have something to stand on, some way of backing up their product, backing up the claims they're making. At the same time, we need a certain amount of critical thinking in our consumers out there. After all, like, I mean, there are so many things out there that you could sue for not being healthy, right? I mean, like, you know, chocolate bars are great. I have them every now and then. I have them every now and then. I don't eat them for breakfast. I don't think it's fair for me to sue, you know, Hershey's because I got a load of cavities from eating their chocolate.
No, but you have been eating a lot of that fatty bacon. So, you know, I'm...
Well, yeah. But it is all natural.
that's true.
Until they're growing in, you know, bats somewhere.
Right. Well, and even then, they're natural. Because, I mean,
everything's part
of nature.
I guess they are organic, you know. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fair enough.
That's a whole other debate. But what about the role of regulation here? I mean, we've talked before about picking our battles.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I think, again, that you cannot lie in advertising. But, I mean, at what point do you say, like you say, you know, is it part of a healthy breakfast? If you have, like, you know, a small half ounce of it on your toast, and that was the only sort of sugar content in your breakfast, I guess it could qualify that. But again, if you sit there and say, if you eat and they show you putting on like an inch thick layer on your toast and saying, this is part of a nutritious breakfast, that crosses the boundaries. But should we be spending our efforts watchguarding that then and not the other?
Well, it depends on who the we is, I guess, in the situation. I mean, certainly there are more important things that we can be doing as a society. That being said, if there could be some way that the responsibility for this sort of thing could be put perhaps maybe on official shoulders, but not the most burdened of soldiers. But you know what I mean? Like, I think there's a certain point where we're kind of overloading the already kind of neutered organizations that we have that are designed to regulate, truth in advertising. If we keep asking them to look at things, they're going to have really no time to do anything. So we need to have perhaps more of a shotgun approach to this, perhaps.
You know, and actually this ties in with the story we did a little while ago about labeling laws and the fact that the Canadian government has essentially said, well, we're no longer going to enforce nutritional labels on products. Because you are right. In the one sense, you could say, well, you know, you should have enough sense to know that if it tastes sweet and it, you know, it seems really, really good, it's probably not. The woman in question and most people could take a look at the nutritional label and see that 90% of what they're eating is sugar and fat. And you could say, well, there, you should have known. But Nutella, at least conceivably now in Canada, could say that there's zero fat and zero sugar in their product. And unless a consumer complains, and even then when they do complain now with the way the law is written, they're complaining to Ferrero, the manufacturer, and the manufacturer might say, we don't care, right?
Yeah.
You know, so part of, I think, where the regulation could come into is not so much necessarily policing advertising, which they maybe can do to a certain degree, but the whole idea of making sure that people have the appropriate information to make the judgment on their own. I mean, if you don't know what's in what you're eating, then there's no way for you to actually make an informed choice. And ultimately, I think that's where government regulation in this kind of case would step in. It's not so much to say, don't do this, but make sure people are making informed choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a fair way of putting it. And we'll keep our eye on future Nutella news that breaks here on Radio Free Thinker, of course.
One could say that we may be able to take our analytical minds and apply it to this problem and other problems.
You could do that. And what it turns out is that analytical mindset might mean you're an atheist. See, that is the premise of a new paper that's being published, making the news here in UBC and elsewhere. If you're good at math, you might be an atheist. And this study is produced by UBC psychologist Will Gervais, who was the author of the study about trusting atheists. We discussed it in a previous episode. Really interesting stuff this fellow is up to. This new study by Gervais, conducted with fellow psychologist Ara Norzanen, posed some analytical math questions to subjects. The hypothesis was that people who answered with more analytical answers, opposed to more sort of innate or intuitive answers, would be a predictor of religious belief. So an example of the question they were asking: if a baseball and bat cost $110 and the bat costs $100 more than the ball, how much does the ball cost? What do you think, Don?
I don't know. 110 minus 100 would be the simplistic answer.
Right. So if you did say $10, which is the wrong answer, that's what if you kind of go, that's more sort of an intuitive, I guess, what they call an intuitive answer. I don't know. That's what I would have said as well, because I'm terrible at math. But apparently the right answer, which apparently requires a bit of analysis, is $5. The bat costs $105. So what they discovered is that the people who sort of took that time, who analyzed the question, they're more likely to have no or less religious belief in people who sort of came with the innate sort of gut answer.
Holy crap, Ethan. Does that mean we believe in God now?
Well, that's perhaps one of the things that this implies.
Oh, I pray that we're not.
Yeah, me too. So their study of 179 Canadian undergraduate students showed that people who tend to solve problems more analytically also tended to be religious disbelievers. This was demonstrated by giving the students a series of questions like the one that I just mentioned, and then scoring them on a basis of whether they used intuition or analytical logic to reach the answers. Afterwards, the researchers surveyed the students on whether or not they held religious beliefs. The results showed that the intuitive thinkers were more likely to believe in religion. So, being good skeptics, what do we have here? This is correlation. Now, do we have causation? Well, turns out we do. to test for a causal relationship between the analytical thinking and the religious disbelief, the researchers devised four different ways to promote analytical thinking and then surveyed the students to see if their religious disbelief had increased or decreased based on these interventions that boosted critical thinking. So they would basically prime the students. And we've sort of talked about this phenomenon before, you know, whether it's listening to classical music or looking at, you know, certain works of art. But what they saw was that you can sort of temporarily boost somebody's analytical thinking and then give them a questionnaire about, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, like, how religious are you, that kind of thing.
Right.
And it turns out that the more boosted their analytical thinking is, the more likely they are to rate themselves lower on the scale of religious belief. Whether or not they're atheists or believers, they just go down a bit.
So priming. So when they first did the survey, how much you believe in religious beliefs or something like that, let's pretend it was me, I said 7 out of 10. Then you gave me this hard analytical task, and then you asked me again how well I did, and I said 5 or 4 or something less. So it's not that I was an atheist to begin with or I had disbelief to begin with. It's that literally doing the analytical task caused my ability to associate with religious belief to decrease.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because if you're a very analytical person and you answer those math questions correctly, but I can't, it is a strong predictor of religious disbelief. So that's okay. That's one thing. But then what they were able to show is that you can actually sort of make people more analytical with these priming methods, which are not necessarily questions, but they're more sort of like, look at this, you know, funny picture for 5 minutes, right? We are familiar with the priming techniques.
Yep.
And this can make someone who's maybe normally a 7 go down to a 5 on the scale of 1 to 10 being, 1 being the lowest, 10 being the highest amount of religious belief. So pretty interesting. Now, the thing is, priming is certainly temporary. So, you know, maybe somebody comes in to this study and they show them the picture, they go down 2 points for 20 minutes, they leave, 20 minutes later, they're back up to being a 7, right?
True. Although, you know, and this is advice that anyone listening who does these sort of debates with the theologically minded, is at the beginning of your presentation, you should say, this is going to seem a little odd, but I'm going to show you this particular puzzle up there that's going to force you to be analytical. And then you go in and you do your debate. And I guess almost the way this is sort of implying that people are going to be much more amiable to your particular skeptical views than you will to the religious views just by getting them to do this little non sequitur analytical task before you do this sort of debate.
Yeah, and some of the things that they were actually using, for example, were like a jumble of words. So they would have like think, reason, analyze, ponder, rational, opposed to words like hammer, shoes, jump, retrace, brown. And the words that, you know, kind of provoked thought would have the impact, whereas the ones that didn't were sort of like the control, essentially.
I wonder if they did more, I will say moral words, good, evil, sin, whether you would have got a boost going the opposite direction.
Well, the funny thing is, like, because this study sort of made the rounds of news and you had all kinds of people sort of chiming in with this, a lot of religious commentators were chiming in saying, oh, well, this is actually very interesting. It's, you know, the ones who were more accommodating were saying things like, you know, this doesn't ignite any kind of science versus religion debate because religion is the only thing that can answer questions like good and evil, morality and ethics and that kind of stuff. And, well, obviously not. But, you know, it is kind of interesting to see the other interpretation of this, which is that science is kind of just that sort of cold, analytical, perhaps nerdy side of things, whereas religion represents the kind of emotional, intuitive, gut instinct aspect, which does kind of sync up with sort of some of the other things that we've discussed in the past regarding sort of the demographics of religious belief, whereas we tend to think that, you know, a lot of atheists are more educated, a bit more wealthy perhaps, for whatever reason. And the religious, the deeply religious, like remember when we looked at that poll of the wealth, some of the poorest people in the world were very, very religious. So this does indicate that there is some connection there.
Well, actually, you know, and that does, because if you think about it, if you're successful in academia, as in you've gone to university, you've got a degree or what have you, irrespective of what you've learned, you're trained to be analytical thinking. That's part of why you go to a university. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even if, I guess, in theory, if you were doing religious studies, which would sort of reinforce some of it, but you still have to be analytical. And actually, there's a lot of people who become apostates after having gone to seminary school and all that, because in the process of gaining their credentials, they're forced to be analytical. And even in business, as much as I distaste business and for moral reasons, you have to be analytical to be successful in business, right? I mean, if you do not weigh out the pros and cons of something like that. So, I don't know, maybe we should mandate something that could be a good authoritarian response.
Well, the funny thing is here, I am probably the worst person at math in the world. True. I'm pretty sure I'm pretty bad at it.
No, but I think you're missing the point. I mean, it's not so much the math in and of itself, because the words kind of imply that, right?
Yeah.
So you may have a deficiency in math, and I share that, right? That's why we're probably more into the art side of academia than the science side.
Sure.
But when it comes to other problem solving, we are very analytical in how we do it. I mean, again, anyone who's listened to our show knows quite often, almost to ad nauseum, we take a very methodical, very analytical approach to issues.
That is true. We definitely do that. So I don't know, though. But I mean, like, it is kind of interesting that, because we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, where a story will get a lot of press, not so much based on its content, but on its inflammatory headline. And this one, you know, sort of that math on one side, atheism on the other side, has gotten this story a lot of press.
True. And actually, as much as, you know, we hope to have Will Gervais on our show at some point in the future. But again, this was a relatively small study. I mean, it was 140 people, which is better than some. Some are like 30 people, and it was internet one. So, I mean, it was an accredited sort of study. But, I mean, how much of his previous work has been emulated and replicated in other parts? And I must admit, I have not heard of those, and I'm sure they exist. But that's another test to this whole premise.
Yeah, and I think Gervais is, I think he's a graduate student, so I mean, he's probably hasn't reached that level where his studies are getting replicated just yet.
But you would think with the amount of press, I mean, because he does, he generates an inordinate amount of press, because for some reason, religion and atheism is a hot-button topic.
I don't know what that's about, but like I said, we hope to connect with him eventually. I know he's given a few talks for the UBC Freethinkers. So, well, why don't we take a break here on Radio Freethinker? We'll be back with more after this.
On drugs.
On drugs, for sure.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
April and Discorder is here. Daffodils are blooming, cherry blossoms blossoming, and Discorder smells spring fresh off the presses. Check inside for monthly faves, The Overeducated Grumbler, on the topic of Dan Levy, getting textually active with rock stars, and news on the venues you know and love. Read up on the lovelies of Ruffled Feathers, Indigo Kids, and Dirty Spells, and figure out where to pick up hard copies of their stuff at your favorite local record store on Record Store Day. Reviews, calendars, charts, interviews, art projects, photos, write-ups, and teardowns, all that and more in your free April issue of Discorder. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
And we're back. So, recently in the news, there was a story about a mother's anguish after having left her drug-addicted son at what she thought was a reputable private drug treatment center, but later discovered otherwise. The center, the Narconon Drug Prevention and Rehabilitation Center in Trois-Rivières, received $10,000 for initial treatment. However, after only 6 days, the center put her son back on a bus to Toronto. He was addicted, he was penniless, and he was essentially on the street. They claimed he was too psychotic for them to deal with. Now, granted, while he was there, he cut himself several times. He wolfed down a bottle of rubbing alcohol because, again, he was addicted. But I thought it was kind of interesting that they said for psychotic reasons, because I thought one of the tenets of Scientology was they didn't believe in psychosis or anything like that. It's all thetans that cause your thing, and you shouldn't use drugs to treat psychotic behavior.
Right, and just so everyone is on the same page, this woman took her son to this place. She didn't realize it was a front for Scientology, right?
Essentially, yes. Well, we can go more into that a little later as to why she did there, because I think that's ultimately part of the heart of the story.
Okay.
But yeah, she was desperate to find some place to take her son. This was one place that would take him, and so she took him there.
I see.
Since the incidents came to light, the attempts by the center to gain accreditation has failed. So, according to news reports, it's now closed its doors. It has been actually operating under provisional credentials and sort of previous lax laws. Essentially, you could set up a center, and you didn't actually have to get licensing until quite recently. And even then, you were sort of allowed to run for like 4 or 5 years before you actually had to get your actual license. So they were closed this year almost more because the law had changed in their favor, not so much because of this incident. The Trois-Rivières Center claims to have successfully treated over 1,200 patients. However, at least in interviews, when pressed about the idea of conversion to Scientology, as Ethan was sort of mentioned, the head of the center said that they, quote, don't track what happens to most people after they leave the Trois-Rivières program. So now with addiction, getting an addict actually to stop drugs is not actually that hard. The real trick of the matter is to keep them off the drugs in the long term. Narcanon is not Narcanon. So Narconon versus Narcanon. Narcanon is an offshoot of Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, which uses a traditional 12-step program, which I have some issues with, but that's a different show.
Right.
It was started in the 1950s. It doesn't actually charge its members. And again, it's not designed so much to get people off drugs, but to keep people off drugs. Now, this is a major difference between the two NARCs. Narconon is, as Ethan pointed out, actually part of Scientology's web of entities and was established in the late 60s. The treatment is actually based upon L. Ron Hubbard's, quote, The Fundamentals of Thought, a book he wrote, among other writings he had done. It was developed by a former felon, William Bendent, and was formally incorporated into Scientology in 1972. The principle behind the treatment is based on the idea that addiction is caused by fat. That is that drugs are absorbed into the fat while you're getting stoned, and that when you're not high, the drug is released back into the bloodstream by the fat, causing the craving of the drugs and thus the addiction. So their treatment or their detox is essentially sweating the drugs out. It also includes things like high doses of vitamins, lots of liquids, because if you're going to be sweating a lot, you need to replace the liquids, a balanced diet, plenty of sleep. And of course, I mean, those other things are... they're good health tips in general, and a lot of these people who are addicted quite often suffer from poor health, poor nutrition, poor sleep. Now, there are some drugs that can actually be absorbed by the fat. Opiates in general is one of the big ones, and barbiturates, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not really the biggie. So things like cocaine, meth, PCP, they don't actually ever get absorbed from the fat. And even if they did, I mean, the fundamental idea behind this is that your addiction is caused by sort of the slow re-release of the drug into your blood system, which logically and medically would actually have the opposite effect, because if you sort of had this slow trickle in your bloodstream, it would relieve withdrawal symptoms and actually lead you to be less addicted.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, that's sort of the opposite of addiction, isn't it? I mean, that's how you get people off a lot of these drugs. Like when people get addicted to like morphine. Or what's the one that they get addicted to? Not morphine, it's...
heroin.
Heroin, and then they use morphine to get them off heroin. That's how they do it, isn't it? They slowly give you less and less amounts until you sort of wean yourself off it.
Well, yeah, no, actually, so, what they do is they will give you sort of a replacement drug. And actually, that goes into a second area that, you know, even if we say, well, the biology that they're using is ineffective, or maybe it works on people, like, who are pot smokers or something, who they're psychologically addicted, but they're not physically addicted. But for those people who are physically addicted, such as the boy who we talked about at the beginning of the story, withdrawal itself is not only painful, but is potentially fatal. When the center claimed that, you know, he was experiencing psychotic behavior, well, that's what you get with withdrawal. That's why a responsible entity like NarcAnon leaves detox to doctors and proper treatment centers where they can address these other symptoms of withdrawal.
Right.
In fact, for some forms of addiction, to stop cold turkey can actually be fatal. I mean, you literally will die from not having the drug. That is why some addictions are so hard to beat, is because it's no longer I want to have this. It's I literally physically need to have it or I will die. That's part of the reason why one of the things that they do to reduce the risk and withdrawal symptoms, which can last for months, is give things like methadone, which is actually a replacement drug. So it is an opiate like heroin, like you were talking before, mm-hmm. but it is a less addictive form of it. So you kind of wean yourself off.
Yeah. And that's sort of my understanding of it has always been that kind of the detox side is kind of done like in a hospital under medical supervision, because as you say, that is a more physical situation. Whereas the treatment and the sort of getting you to the point where you no longer want drugs, that's a psychological treatment. That can be done in a place, you know, like, well, not this place, obviously, but a place that this place is trying to be like.
Yeah. No, you're right. And like I say, you know, you have proper medical staff and you treat the physical symptoms of it. As I kind of mentioned before, one of the main tenets of Scientology, which is, again, this place is a part of and strongly associated with, is you don't believe in psychiatric drugs.
Right.
And one of the things a lot of withdrawal symptoms are things like anxiety, insomnia, depression, paranoia, all these sort of things, which if you had a proper sort of regiment of psychotic drugs to help you over this sort of hump, you can actually reach the point where talk therapy and all those sort of things to deal with the psychological, like the genuine mental parts of it, you know, you can actually deal with.
Right.
Now, okay, so medically it's dubious at best and dangerous at worst. There's also the whole issue of conversion. As Ethan sort of jumped in, did the woman know this was Scientology or not? Now, Scientology, of course, claims that it does not use these centers as a venue for recruiting members. But because of the secret nature of this, quote, church, it's actually very hard to substantiate this claim. What is true is that part of the treatment is, quote, training routines, which is essentially Scientology's regular audit session, but with a slight narco twist. Now, I came across a quote from the California State Health Department's review of a NarcAnon center that was receiving federal funding in the 70s. So the state sent in a review person to take a look at what they were doing, and they wrote a report, should we continue funding, should we not, right? And one of the things that they talked about, which I think is classic Scientology, is, and I'm quoting here, the exercise of direct eye contact tolerance, i.e. staring into the coach's eye in eyes open, is seeking for an emotional weak spot or button and a corresponding emotional response to it by bull baiting routine. The bull baiting exercise seems to involve principally physical characteristics that may be used to embarrass or humiliate an individual and condition them to accept and control the response to this verbal threat to the body image. Well, one of the mechanisms that Scientology uses to both convert and retain its converts is to destroy the sort of self-esteem. Essentially, you're brainwashing them. And these are very vulnerable people who are going to these centers, and they already have a whole plethora of issues. And you sit there, and part of the treatment is to say, Ethan, that beard, my God, how could you possibly have that ugly beard, you worthless piece of, you know? And then you've got to sit back and just say, okay, thank you. And you, and the idea is to control your response. But really, you're driving them down so you can rebuild them up in Scientology's image. And not to mention, part of these sort of auditing sessions, and again with these training routines, is, you know, they record a lot of what is said, if not everything that is said. Mm-hmm. And Scientology has had a history in the past of taking these confessions and using them to blackmail people who are threatening to leave or to expose Scientology in the future.
Well, and just the thing about eye contact, that's a really interesting thing that they do, because eye contact is something very difficult for people who are going through psychological problems. I mean, I know that for certain people who have different conditions, it's very, very, very difficult for them to maintain eye contact with somebody. And to sort of force that on somebody, it's kind of like sort of psychological torture almost. I mean, the level of effort that real healthcare professionals go through to make sure that they're making somebody feel comfortable and safe so that they can go through psychological training or treatment, it's pretty extreme. And that these guys are using this as sort of a tactic really speaks volumes about their intentions. Not so much to help, but like you said, to sort of recruit their little cult.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, like I say, these are such classical brainwashing type techniques. And in and of itself, is sort of horrible, but their target audience here are people, like we said before, classic symptoms of withdrawal are anxiety, paranoia, that sort of thing. To put these people through this sort of technique, it takes the whole idea of tough love to torture love.
Oh, yeah.
And again, they say it's in order to rebuild their self-esteem or what have you, but I don't see how that works by tearing them down in the first place.
Right.
Now, of course, the last thing I think we'll discuss on this, and I'm not sure if it's actually the last way that Narcanon is slimy, is this method of finding patients. I guess it's simple capitalism in one sense, is that they offer a commission for every patient that goes through treatment. Reports from insiders say that of the $30,000 treatment fee, this is normally what they get, $30,000 to $40,000 for a 3 or 4 month stint, $3,000 of that is paid to a recruiter. So even if we ignore the other parts, this seems, well slimy. To be fair, high-end treatment centers, like the Hollywood stars would go to or whatever, would pay that much in a month. But most other centers, like Narcanon is not that kind of center. It's more of your person on the street sort of center, which, of course, is obviously what this one boy was that we started with. But they charge for people who can't get public funding, and most of them get public funding, about $14,000. So it's an exorbitant sort of amount. And I noticed that in my research, every center of this sort of class makes it as one of the requirements before they will accept you is that you must be detoxed before they'll take you. So these are treatment centers to keep you off drugs, but they know that, you know, they're not designed to detoxify you. That needs to be done by a medical institution.
Right, absolutely.
This actually leads to what I think is the heartbreaking part of the whole thing, is the real tragedy of this isn't so much that Narcanon exists, although that's kind of horrible, but the reason why the mother sent her to this center, and you were asking me this earlier, Ethan, was because there's no publicly funded treatment spots open. There was no place for her literally to send her son. And this is because, again, we have funding cuts by federal, provincial governments, and people will end up not only falling through tracks, because right now her son is on the street and a drug addict, but it also leaves people vulnerable to these private institutions. Some of them may be quite reputable, but a number of them are not, and they leave them vulnerable. And the whole point of society, to create a society, is to protect everyone, and especially the weak and the infirm in it.
Absolutely. Frightening story, actually.
Yes.
But, you know, we are running out of time here on the show. We should probably go to our skeptical highlights.
I have two this week.
Good.
One, which is kind of my classic one, it's about conspiracy theories.
Ooh. Yay!
Philosopher's Cafe has moderator Amir Kamal Najib question the beliefs that there are secret societies that run the world, you know, that have the power to break authority. Essentially, he's taking on your classic conspiracy theories. I suspect, as nice as this is going to be, it's going to be preaching to the choir, because I think anyone who goes there who really believes in conspiracy theories will just assume he's part of the conspiracy.
Wait, is the cafe suggesting that there are secret societies that are controlling the world, or that there aren't secret societies controlling the world?
They're not.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yes. From what I've been able to gather about the talk, he is saying, well, let's use our sort of analytical approaches to this sort of this thing and see this. Now, of course, I'm going to try and get in contact with him to get him on our show, because if he does believe in the woo, that could be even more interesting.
Yeah, for him probably, not for us.
No, but I am assuming, again, because again, the Philosopher's Cafe does not have a lot of preamble to this, but if it's going to be part of SFU's Philosopher's Cafe, to have a real whack noodle on their speaking circuit would seem to be a bit... Although he did do a previous one where he was discussing about arranged marriages and why they're actually a good thing, or at least there are good parts to them. Now, this is happening on May 2nd, i.e. tomorrow, at 7 p.m. It's free, and it's being held at The Grind on Main Street. Now, another highlight I have, which is a little odd one, it's Google Apps. And, okay. In fact, it's a particular Google app for Chrome. It's probably available on your... Android tablets as well, although I haven't checked for that. Ethan, you can check for that later. But it's simple. It's called the periodic table. And essentially what it is, it's a shooting game where they give you the medal and you got to find it on the periodic table on there. And I know, incredibly geeky, nerdy thing, but I like taking maps and they say, where is Malawi? And I got to find it on the map. And so this is sort of Antonym. Where is Antonym on the periodic table? And you got to shoot Antonym. And it's pure geek, but it was fun geek.
Well, that's good. I love like sciencey games for my my tablet. I have a skeptical highlight as well. This one is the Surly Amy Grants for Tam 10. So Surly Amy is a artist slash blogger on the Skeptic Network. She makes various types of jewelry with a skeptical theme, and she's trying to raise some money this year for grants to help women who wouldn't normally be able to afford to attend TAM this year. So you can purchase these limited edition handmade Surly Ramics. They're called You Can Make a Difference necklaces, or you can buy a whole bunch of them. 50% of the proceeds will be donated to the JREF to pay for the grants. And you can also donate money directly to the cause if jewelry isn't your thing. And you can, if you donate it via the JREF, you can get a tax receipt for your donation. I don't know if that works for Canadians or not, but just check it out to be on the safe side. Last year, they raised enough money for 14 tickets to TAM. That's a lot of money.
Wow.
So all the info will be online. We'll link to it in our show notes. It's a great cause, and I've bought a few of Surly Amy's jewelry. They're actually really cool stuff, lots of pro-science, pro-skeptical stuff on them. So get to buy a couple for your friends and help make a really tangible difference for somebody's life.
And I will assume we will have links both to Surly and TAM on our website.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Well, we're right out of time here on Radio Freethinker.
It's amazing how time keeps moving.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I guess that's the future.
That's how it works, apparently. Yeah. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
See you next week, folks.
Do you want to make the right impression during your big interview? Arts Co-op would like to help. The ultimate package from the Arts Co-op Student Association includes a professional portfolio, business cards, and a USB pen. For more information, email acsapromo@gmail.com.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.